Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. You are listening to Latin Waves, and your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm delighted to be joined by Jorge Martí. He is the Secretariat of Hands Up Venezuela. Welcome to our show, Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Now, the recent uprisings in Chile began as a student's protest against the proposed fare increases for public transportation. It has quickly evolved into general waves of protest against the government and against the increasing inequality. Can we talk a little bit about what is happening in the region and how this may have contributed to the recent military coup in Bolivia?
Yes, really, we see a situation of enormous turmoil throughout Latin America. Just before the Chile uprising, which is continuing to this day, we saw the uprising in Ecuador when the government announced a package of IMF measures and immediately was met with a massive uprising. The government had to flee the capital and finally abolish some of the measures that they had introduced in order to placate the mass movement. But not only that, we also see an uprising in Haiti against a corrupt and anti-working class government, which has been going on for 8 weeks with more than 200 people being killed. We see the preparation of a general strike in Colombia for the 21st of November, big mass movement in Honduras. And now the latest development is the coup in Bolivia. So the whole continent is in turmoil. There is a move towards revolution, but at the same time, we also see the ugly head of counter-revolution rising up.
Most of Latin Americans are familiar with military coups and with U.S. intervention. The CIA has been known to, you know, interfere in removing elected governments throughout the region. Can this recent coup be also taken in that letter, and why would the U.S. be so interested in bringing down the government of Evo Morales?
Queen Bolivia should be analyzed in full. First of all, we need to clarify that this is a coup. There are some people objecting to this description. They say it was a constitutional move. The Wall Street Journal, for instance, published an editorial saying it was a breakthrough for democracy, but it was really a coup. The government was forced to resign on the basis of mutiny in the police, the army making a very public statement suggesting, in inverted commas, that the president should go. And the OAS, the Organization of American States, also contributed to this coup by releasing a report declaring there had been irregularities in the election and so on. So it is clearly a coup. It's a coup that's backed by the United States, as seen by the fact that as soon as the new coup president was proclaimed, appointed herself yesterday, the first government to recognize the new government was a government of Trump in the United States, and then followed very swiftly by the governments of Colombia and the government of Brazil, the government of Bolsonaro. So it's quite clear that they were involved, and they never reconciled themselves with the idea of this government, the government of Evo Morales, who was elected in more than 14 years ago now, after the big revolutionary movements of 2003 and 2005, when the workers and the peasants came out on the streets, defeated an attempt to privatize natural gas, and overthrew two governments in the process. And the government of Evo Morales was a byproduct of that revolutionary movement. The workers did not win, did not take power fully, but finally they expressed themselves through elections and they voted for the movement to socialism of Evo Morales. And he's been reelected ever since in democratic elections. But at the same time, we must also see how the policies of Evo Morales in more recent years have seen a sharp turn. He started to compromise with the ruling class. He made agreements with the land-owning oligarchy in Santa Cruz, where the main leaders of the coup come from. He also made an agreement with multinationals handing over the natural resources of the country. For instance, he signed a deal to a German multinational for some lithium deposits in Potosí. And finally, he also made a deal with Almagro, the general secretary of the OAS, the person who's been at the forefront of the attempts to remove the government in Venezuela, made a deal with him in order to be able to stand again in the elections. And he himself, Evo Morales, invited the Organization of American States to oversee the elections, and they finally delivered the final blow, the final stabbing in the back against his government. Of course, the problem is that if you are a left government elected by workers and peasants, and then you carry out a policy of conciliation with the ruling class, the problem is that you then lose support from amongst your own social base, workers and peasants. Evo Morales went from 63% of the vote to 47% in this latest election on the 20th of October. But at the same time, you do not really gain the support of the ruling class. The ruling class, the imperialists, the Santa Cruz oligarchy, the landowners, the capitalists, the bankers, the military, they never reconciled themselves with the idea of this government. Of course, they took any concessions that Evo Morales was giving them with both hands. But they just waited for the right moment to overthrow this government and to knock out from the workers and peasants of Bolivia the idea that they can have a say in the running of the country, that they can have control over the natural resources, and that they can have a government that responds to their own interests. So I will say that big policy mistakes made by Evo Morales contributed to undermining his social base, and then it made it more difficult to resist the coup. And the same people that he was making deals with and concessions to are the ones who carried out the coup. That doesn't mean, of course, that we must oppose this coup. This is a completely undemocratic, reactionary coup, which has now brought to power the most reactionary elements from within the ruling class in Bolivia, people based in Santa Cruz, who are not only reactionary, they're also racist towards the indigenous majority in the country. They are Bible-bashing Catholic fundamentalists. The new president, self-appointed president, Áñez, said in her swearing-in ceremony that she was going to be guided by the Bible. The Bible was again in the house of the people, and the coup leader Camacho, who comes from a fascist background in Santa Cruz as well, he also said Christ is with us here again, and then they proceeded to burn down the indigenous flag, the Huipala, which obviously led to massive resistance by the indigenous people in Bolivia. The story of this coup is not finished yet. But first of all, it is a coup. Second of all, it must be opposed firmly by all socialists, progressive people, and by all Democrats, really. And thirdly, the interests behind this coup are the interests of U.S. imperialism, resource-hungry multinationals, the landowners and bankers and capitalists in Bolivia, with the support of their allies in the region, Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Duque in Colombia.
What is most alarming, I fear, is that we have witnessed so many coups in the region so close by. You know, the coup in Venezuela, which had failed, but we're also seeing now the turmoil around the region. Can we talk a little bit about the resistance, you know, because as you point out, the people, the Bible and religion has always been hand in hand with the colonizing efforts of, you know, centuries now. And it is always with this very well flowery, you know, language of Christ that many genocides of indigenous people have been committed. So let's talk about what this symbols, what this signals for us who are moving away from the history of colonization and the woundings that we all carry, you know, as a result of it, and the racism that simply has been normalized and we've been schooled to accept it, to adapt to it.
I will say that the ongoing uprising in Chile is a very good example of that. I mean, for 30 years after the end of the dictatorship, Chile was seen as an oasis, a model for capitalist development in Latin America, a country where they told us the harshest and more unfettered capitalist methods were being used. And this had led, allegedly, to a rise in living standards. And therefore, this was the model for the ultra-liberals, for the Chicago boys, that had to be followed throughout Latin America if progress had to be achieved. But in reality, what was hidden behind this so-called model was a policy of attacks on the working class, the deregularization of labor, the overexploitation of the working class, the destruction of trade union rights and labor protection measures, and also the privatization of natural resources. The copper mines, even water, running water was privatized. The privatization of pensions with the creation of the private pension funds, which meant a deterioration of the conditions of pensioners, and a whole series of attacks on also on state education, university education, and so on, which made Chile a very successful country, apparently on the surface of the big economic figures, but at the same time, one of the most unequal societies in the whole of the continent. I think Chile is the second most unequal society in the OECD countries. And so this stoked an enormous amount of anger and opposition. There was a huge movement of the secondary school students in 2006. And there were two big movements of the university students for free education in 2011 and 2013. There was a huge demonstrations against the private pension funds. There were struggles and strikes of the dock workers and the miners, copper miners. And all of this combined to create this massive social explosion, which also, I think it's interesting to note, was also an explosion for national democratic rights of the Mapuche people, which have been traditionally oppressed for 200 years. Today is the anniversary of the killing of a young Mapuche activist, Catrillanca, a year ago by the police, by the Carabineros, the Chilean police, which led to a massive uprising, not only in the Mapuche areas, but a solidarity uprising across Chile. All of these different factors have combined to create this uprising that's now been going on for over three weeks, which the government is unable to put down. It's not been put down by repression, and there has been massive repression. Over 2,000 people have been injured. Over 200 have lost sight in one eye. I think that more than 20 people have been killed so far. There's been massive repression, the use of the army on the streets, state of emergency, a curfew, which was in place for a few days, 3 weeks ago. None of this has stopped the movement. And also the so-called concessions of the Piñera government have also not convinced the movement. The movement is still strong. 2 days ago, there was a general strike, which paralyzed the whole country. So millions of people on the streets. There's been two huge marches in the capital, Santiago, with over a million people in each of them. And so this movement, as people say in Chile, is not a movement about 30 pesos, which was the rise in the increase in the transport fares, which originally sparked the movement about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's a movement about 30 years of cuts, austerity policies, discrimination, attacks on the working class, cuts in social spending, and so on. And this has resulted in this massive, marvelous movement that we see now. So I think that this is very significant because it pulls together all the different threads. Not only attacks on conditions, wages, education, healthcare, but also the national democratic rights of the Mapuche people. And all of this has created this uprising, which reflects conditions that to one degree or another exist in all of the other Latin American countries. The uprising in Ecuador also had a very strong indigenous character to it, but it was a class uprising, the rising of workers and peasants against IMF-imposed package of neoliberal measures. In Argentina, we also saw the big defeat of the Macri government, right-wing government, had been carrying out right-wing policies for the best part of 4 years and was defeated at the polls. But if there had been no polls at the time, this government would have probably been overthrown because the people were so angry. The economy is in free fall. There has been like three or four different general strikes. So we see throughout the continent a mood of rebellion, uprising, and governments that are now seriously threatened with overthrow. And the ruling class, I think, is very, very worried.
Now, the global capitalist crisis that seems to be ongoing, but the latest version of it and that began in 2008 has seemed to deepen and is threatening to worsen in the region. What lessons can we learn from from this experiences that we've had now in Bolivia and Venezuela and when we have fascist governments rising and also the mass uprisings that come with it?
And the problem is that these governments were part of a revolutionary wave, but once in power, they never completed the revolution. They challenged the power of the capitalists, the bankers, and the landowners and imperialists, and they got really angry. They attempted coups and all sorts of tricks to overthrow these governments. But these governments really never, even though, for instance, in Venezuela, Chavez talked about socialism, they never really completed revolution. They never really expropriated the political power from the multinationals and the local capitalists still have. And this has created conditions for the undermining of these projects and the popular support. Around 2014, the impact of the world capitalist crisis hit the prices of raw materials. It went down very rapidly. In the case of oil, for instance, which is the main export item for Venezuela, the price of oil went from $110 a barrel to $27 a barrel in the space of a few months. It's now recovered a little bit, but not much. And same can be said for other raw materials, sources of energy that these countries export, and that's the way they insert it in the world market, a very dependent way. So when these prices of raw materials went down, these governments were left without any room for maneuver. They could no longer carry out social policies without challenging the power of the capitalists. And at this point, they decided to start making deals with the capitalists and implementing other types of policies. This led to a decrease in social support for these governments, and many of them got into trouble or were removed. In Argentina, for instance, in Ecuador, the Venezuelan 2005 National Assembly elections were lost, and so on. So I will say the main, and same thing is happening now in Bolivia. I will say the main lesson is if you start a revolution, you need to finish the job. As the French revolutionary Saint-Just said, if you make half a revolution, you're digging your own grave. There's no room for conciliation. There's no room for compromise with the capitalist class. They will take any concessions you make to them, but then they will wait for the right moment to try to overthrow your government. I think that this needs to be the clear message that comes out of all of this, particularly the coup in Bolivia. As I said, the coup is still not completed. I mean, in the sense that they have a new government, illegitimate coup plotting government of Añez. But there is still massive resistance in the streets. There's the beginning of a fight back on the part of the workers' movement, the indigenous people are up in arms in El Alto, in the Chapare, and in other parts of the country. But in order to fight back against this coup in an effective way, we also, I think, need to learn the lessons of the mistaken policies that the government carried out, which also undermined its social base of support.
How would you encourage people to support the people of Bolivia? How would you encourage the world, to support the revolutionary process underway in Latin America?
Well, first of all, I will say that working people are just one class around the world. We have the same interests. We are exploited by the same capitalists in different degrees. Whether we live and work in Vancouver or in Madrid or in London or in Lisbon, or whether we do that in Caracas, in La Paz, or in Santiago de Chile, we are the same class. So therefore, a victory for our class in any country is a victory for all of us. And it encourages movements and developments in other countries. But a defeat for our class in Bolivia or in Venezuela or in any other country also encourages our enemies. For instance, in the last few days after the coup in Bolivia, we have seen, for instance, reactionary thugs trying to occupy the Venezuelan embassy in Brasilia, in the capital of Brazil. We have seen the reaction in Venezuela calling for a big demonstration this coming Saturday. So they are also encouraged by the victories of their side. So therefore, this is not just a question of solidarity with things that are happening in a country far away about which we know very little, but it's also a matter of life and death for our own struggles. If the people of Bolivia or Venezuela, they manage to win free university education, this is a step forward for the struggle for free education in Canada. And if they are defeated, it's a step back for our struggles as well. So this is the first point. Second point I would say is that people should try to find out the truth about what is happening, because the mass media, the big capitalist newspapers and TV stations, they obviously lie and manipulate about what is really going on. As I said, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, they all supported the coup in Bolivia. Furthermore, they said it was not a coup. It was a breakthrough for democracy, the Wall Street Journal said. So first of all, we need to see through the fog of lies and misinformation that the imperialists are peddling about what's happening in these countries, because that also affects our ability to understand critically what is happening in the class struggle in our own countries. And thirdly, we need to rally, we need to mobilize, and we need to make as much noise as we can, because the coup in Bolivia is also supported by governments that support the interests of the big mining multinationals, Canada being one example of those. And there are others. So therefore, we also have a responsibility. We also fight by developing international solidarity. We're also fighting against the imperialist interests of our own governments and the multinationals in our own countries.
One of the examples that the government of Evo Morales gave us was the presence of indigenous people. He was the first indigenous elected leader worldwide in history. For me, it's not only about reconciling ourselves to create a more inclusive society, but also to end the stench of racism that invades and continues to separate us into us versus them. What inspires you that we can also resist? What inspires you to see that we can pull through and change the course of history, that oppression and exploitation is not our destiny?
Yes, I will say that the uprising in Chile is extremely inspiring. The uprising has not been organized by anyone. It's mostly spontaneous. People themselves have been organizing through cabildos abiertos, which is mass assemblies, asambleas territoriales, neighborhood assemblies. And they have resisted this massive onslaught of repression on the part of the state for more than 3 weeks. And the mass media in Chile also manipulate about what is really going on. They do not report fairly about the movement. They talk about violent thugs and clashes with the police. They don't report about the mass character of the movement. They don't report about the repression. And the people are still on the streets. It's reached the point where they have no fear anymore. I will say, of course, that the fact that they have no leadership is a weakness of the movement. If they had proper leadership, they would have taken power by now. But it's nevertheless extremely inspiring that despite the fact that they have no leadership, they are faced with a very repressive government. Not only the army on the streets, but also the curfew. And we know which army this is. This is the army from the times of the dictatorship of Pinochet. And nevertheless, they have soldiered on, they have continued the movement, and they have a very clear idea of what they don't want. They want the whole regime to go. They want a fundamental change in society. I think that this is very inspiring. And if this is happening in Chile, a country that was used, paraded as a model of capitalist development, this same thing can happen anywhere, really. And we need to be ready. And we need to make sure that in the next country where a movement like this happens, we are able to build a revolutionary leadership that is up to the task and can lead the workers and peasants, our class, to victory once and for all.
You know, we are called, as you said, to be responsible, to respond and to defend not just the right of workers to elect a leader that represents indigenous people, but that also represents all of us, you know, and our need to co-create with nature. I think the significant also impact of Evo Morales was bringing Pachamama into the legislative sphere. How do you see our movements moving through? Should we fail here?
Yes, I mean, the situation is one where the environmental crisis has reached the point where capitalism is really threatening life on the planet. And this is something that also the late president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, made very clearly. He said, look, it's either socialism or barbarism. And this is really the option that is open in front of us. And this has led to the mobilization of millions of very young people who are very worried about the future of our life in this planet, and we don't have another one. And so I think that what we need to recognize is that this capitalism and the thirst for the maximum profit in the short term at any cost that is provoking this environmental crisis. And therefore, this crisis cannot be solved within the confines of capitalism. We can change our individual lifestyles and consumption patterns, but this will not have a fundamental difference up until that point when we take over the big multinationals, which are responsible for this pollution, and we start running the economy in the benefit of the majority in harmony with the environment. The workers and peasants have no interest in destroying the environment. The capitalists do, because they don't care about future consequences. They only care about short-term profitability and the bank accounts and shareholder meetings. So therefore, the only solution, I will say, for the environmental crisis, which has been posed very starkly, is precisely complete change in the mode of production. Socialism, basically, which is the production not for profit, but for human needs in harmony with the environment.
Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people access your work?
It was my pleasure. Yes, well, the Hands of Venezuela, there are some campaigns that are specifically working with the struggle against the coup in Bolivia. Here in Britain is the Bolivia Solidarity Campaign. In other countries, there's coalitions of Latin American campaigns and so on. The Hands of Venezuela campaign can be contacted at handsofvenezuela.org. And I'm also on the editorial board of Marxist.com in defense of Marxism.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Take care.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.